Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Interpretive Political and Social Science, a special series on the New Books Network. Recent years have brought an upsurge in celebrity activism. Not a day goes by without an actor or a musician taking to a stage, a podium, or the internet to speak on a social issue, address an environmental problem, or adopt a political position. While it's easy to be cynical about the motivations of these mostly privileged and frequently uninformed people participating in what sometimes seems like self-serving endeavors, as celebrity activism isn't going away, it seems important for us to think harder about it than that and ask who, after all, is this activism for? And what does it mean that we now live in an age in which celebrities are often elevated over elected political leaders as spokespeople for humanitarianism and human rights? The answers to these questions, Samantha Magic shows in a 2023 book published by the University of California Press, are neither singular nor straightforward. How and why celebrities take up causes, she writes in that book, is shaped and mediated by a range of personal and contextual factors. The book is Lights, Camera, Feminism, Celebrities and Anti-Trafficking Politics. Its author is Professor of Political Science at John Jay College and the Graduate Center, City University of New York. And on this episode, she's speaking with me, Nick Cheeseman, one of the executive committee members for the Interpretive Methodologies and Methods Group of the American Political Science Association and host of the series. Sam, thanks a lot for coming on to New Books in Interpretive Political and Social Science to talk about Lights, Camera, Feminism.
Thank you, Nick, and thank you for having me. And of course, for all of the work you do for this podcast, I know it's a lot of work to read and prepare for these interviews. So I really appreciate this.
Well, thank you for saying that. And it's really a pleasure for me to have these opportunities to speak with authors of great new works like yourself. Can I ask you, first of all, what got you interested in celebrity activism, or more exactly for your purposes, celebrity feminism? And what's the difference between those two terms?
As I've taken to saying, you know, in different presentations about this book, to paraphrase Marx, let's make our labor our life activity. And celebrity gossip has always been kind of my life activity. I mean, I love a good copy of In Touch magazine or Hello or Us Weekly as just kind of the best way to escape from the day. And so that hobby or cultural interest, if you will, increasingly started to intersect with my scholarly work. So I've been doing research about sex work for a number of years. And if you study sex work, you inevitably run into discussions and debates about sex trafficking, because often these two things are conflated in a lot of public discourse. And so I had more and more interest also of just looking into celebrity and politics, because as you said, you know, so well in your introduction, these are people that we are increasingly seeing in many high-profile political and influential spaces. We're seeing them at the UN, we're seeing them in Congress, we're seeing them at the International Labor Organization, all over the place. And so I thought bringing my longer-held knowledge about human trafficking politics into conversation with issues of celebrity in politics might be a way to explore celebrities' roles in our increasingly elite-dominated polity, as I describe it in the book. To your second question, the difference between celebrity activism and celebrity feminism. So celebrity activism generally is when we have a celebrity, so someone who's defined generally as a person who's well known for their athletic, artistic, or other endeavors, and they take on a cause. And so this can be anything, as you said, you know, ranging from environmental causes to right now even speaking out about the conflict in Gaza and Israel. And so celebrity feminism specifically is when celebrities take their what scholars call fame capital, right? So this sort of power and currency that they're granted through their fame, and they apply it to so-called feminist causes. So in some way, generally advancing issues of gender and racial equality, among other concerns of the feminist movement.
So what makes human trafficking a feminist cause? You alluded a moment ago to the interplay between sex trafficking in particular and human trafficking perhaps as a more capacious category. Can you spell out that distinction for the listeners and then return to that previous point about the specifically feminist qualities of this campaign work?
Human trafficking is very generally under international law and different national laws defined as kind of work that takes place under conditions of force, fraud, and coercion. And so this is as old as work itself. But human trafficking became a very contemporary concern with the fall of the Eastern Bloc, kind of with the fall of communism in the late 1980s and with the rise of economic globalization. And so we increasingly saw people moving for work, and that included a lot of women moving for work. And so suddenly what became part of the discussion were NGOs and media outlets picking up stories of women moving places for work, being told that, you know, they were going to come to maybe London or New York or something like that. They're going to work as waitresses or models, and they end up in sex work. This definitely happened. It wasn't what always happened, but it was what happened in many cases and enough to garner a lot of international attention. And so you increasingly had a lot of feminist and labor attention to sex trafficking. But there was a division between activists who really wanted to focus on labor trafficking more broadly in all categories of the economy, and those who particularly came out of the so-called feminist sex wars of the 80s in the United States, who were really concerned with seeing things like prostitution and pornography as a form of violence against women. So human trafficking, and by extension sex trafficking, was kind of the ultimate manifestation of this patriarchal violence, according to some feminist activists on the more radical end of the spectrum. So in this way, human trafficking, in its conflation often with sex trafficking, because we often hear a lot more about sex trafficking in the news, especially from the late 90s, is kind of this, as I describe in the book, a feminist issue par excellence, right? So especially in the dominant narrative of the issue, where the traffickers are men, the victims are predominantly women, and there's a form of sexual exploitation, which many feminists in the more kind of radical end of the spectrum would see as the ultimate form of violence against women.
Let's return in a moment to that dominant narrative. But before we do that, I'd just like to pick up on a couple of other aspects of the book that are important, I think, in setting the discussion up. One is that you describe these celebrities as self-appointed representatives. Now, the choice of the term representative is deliberate and intriguing. Who are they representing, and how do they have the power to appoint themselves to represent them?
It's true. The term, I did select it deliberately, because many times when you watch celebrities speaking about different issues, you hear them speaking in a very sort of typically representative way, saying things like, I am saying this for the women and children here, or I am an advocate for this community, or I am giving a voice to such and such group. So they are, you know, authorizing themselves to speak on behalf of a population or a community or an issue. But the issue is that, unlike more typical electoral representation in politics that we often tend to study more of in political science, nobody has really authorized these people to speak on their behalf. So in many cases, an NGO or a government agency has invited a celebrity to talk about a particular issue. But the community that's most deeply affected by the issue hasn't exactly chosen this person as their spokesperson. And so it's this case of what I call in the book representation at a distance. These are people who are claiming to speak for a community, but they really operate at great remove in many cases from the issue that they're speaking about. And we really see this in the case of human trafficking.
These celebrities have on your account three types of audiences, and one is the represented audience, which you just alluded to. There are two other audiences. One is, to go to your point about authorization, the authorizing audience, and the other is the beneficiary audience. Can you distinguish between those three for listeners?
Wow. Okay. I forgot I even wrote about that, but here we are. So, so you have the, what I call the authorizing audience is the group that has actually asked them to speak. So this might be the members of Congress, for example, or the United Nations General Assembly or something to that effect. Then you have, you know, the affected community. So if we're talking about trafficking, it's often the trafficking victims. And then the beneficiaries are going to be those who more directly benefit from whatever the celebrity might produce. So in some case, this could be legislators who get a piece of legislation passed, maybe with the assistance of a celebrity, but it could also be an overlap with the constituents the celebrities are claiming to represent. So if Jada Pinkett Smith speaking in front of the Senate, for example, helps to reauthorize the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, that is going to in turn benefit or disadvantage, depending on how you look at that piece of legislation, the affected community, the direct constituent, the victims of trafficking.
So is it this quality then of representation and the combination of audiences that makes what you are studying, what you're observing, anti-human trafficking activism political? Where, as it were, do we find the politics of anti-trafficking in the subtitle of the book? Is it the relationship between representation and audience, or is it elsewhere?
It's probably out of fashion now, but when I often think of, you know, what is a very basic definition of politics, I think of Harold Lasswell's definition in 1934 of who gets what, when, and how much, I think, to crudely paraphrase that. And really what you're seeing is a struggle for power. And trafficking politics are very much about struggles for power. So there is the inherent power dynamic in trafficking, right? You presumably have a victim and you have someone in a position of power coercing them in some way to do labor they don't want to do. But then there's an entire policy and advocacy and resource apparatus that's been constructed around the issue of human trafficking. And this has really escalated since the year 2000, when the UN protocol passed on trafficking, and also the United States passed the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which in part conditioned a lot of trafficking aid to foreign countries on their responses to human trafficking. So we suddenly see this emergence of a struggle for resources and power, right? So what governments are getting classified, for example, in the State Department's trafficking in persons reports as tier one, which means they're doing well, according to the United States, on trafficking, versus maybe a tier three, doing not so well. But even within the United States, which is the context that I focus on, you see certain groups getting a lot of resources initially to do work on anti-trafficking activities. So, and predominantly it has gone to groups doing work on sex trafficking. But then you also see other groups trying to get in on a piece of the pie, if you will, in terms of resources, but also to be part of shaping the discourse and how we talk about this issue. And these are all struggles for power at many different levels.
I found the discussion in the book of that infrastructure really, really interesting. And it's one of the reasons, not the only one, but it's one reason that celebrities get involved, because that infrastructure that exists to enable them to. And something that you write about is how, although there were early somewhat ad hoc efforts to include celebrities in the publicity that the United Nations was conducting from the 1950s onwards, it was really when Kofi Annan was the Secretary General that celebrity involvement in the work of international organizations took off. So what was it that Kofi Annan was thinking that he needed celebrities to do that he couldn't otherwise find people, representatives, whether United Nations representatives or others, to do for him?
There's a thing with celebrities, and particularly celebrities commonly from the United States and other Western countries, that have the resources behind them to have this global reach. Like now, for example, when any company makes a movie in Hollywood, not only are they thinking, how is it going to reach Americans, but how is this cultural product going to sell overseas? And so what Kofi Annan was thinking back in the 90s is that celebrities have kind of universal values, right? If everybody loves Brad Pitt, for example, then everybody can potentially love what the United Nations is doing. That's incredibly simplistic, but this is the thinking behind it. And a scholar once described celebrities as proxies for the masses. If people are following what celebrities are doing and liking what the celebrities are doing, then political leaders, legislators, policymakers could kind of follow suit. The fact that they have this global reach means that they could take UN goals and projects, for example, to a wider audience, and people will pay attention because there's the celebrity that they recognize and like.
So in that answer, you mentioned that you focused on the US. Let's come right back into the book and talk about what you did in researching and writing it. Why did you focus on the US, and what type of data did you generate over what period of time?
Oh, Nick, what a mess. You know, I started actually the project on a smaller scale. And I think I cite a couple of the papers I published before this book. And I focused on Ashton Kutcher's Real Men Don't Buy Girls campaign, which was one of the first celebrity-led trafficking campaigns. And so that got me kind of thinking about the issues that arise. And then I started to read more widely about not only celebrities and trafficking, but celebrities and politics. And so to the question about data collection, I basically did snowball sampling where, you know, I had research assistants over the years. And, you know, if you read about Ricky Martin speaking to Congress, they'd Google and they'd look for other examples of Ricky Martin doing all kinds of other things. And so, you know, this kind of just snowballed and created what I think of as a data set, this giant Excel spreadsheet of all these different celebrities and what they've done about trafficking. And, you know, I note their race, their gender, their type of celebrity, a number of the organizations that they've worked with. And then from that, I could kind of get this big picture of what kinds of things are they doing and then who are the most active. But then I didn't want to stop there because I think you only get kind of a surface picture of what's happening. And I wanted to look at celebrities in this activity over time. There's a tendency in a lot of celebrity studies, and you know, I've done it myself, to focus on sort of a single case or a single activity in time. But I wanted to see how things change over time. I also wanted to have to go in depth. And so to go in depth, I looked at who are the celebrities that really seem to be doing the most. And that's where I came up with my case studies of Jada Pinkett Smith and Ashley Judd, Ricky Martin and Ashton Kutcher, and then Julia Ormond and Mira Sorvino. And I focused on the US because it's the context with which I'm most familiar, but also the United States has positioned itself as this global leader, for better or for worse, on trafficking. And again, as I said, you know, it publishes these annual trafficking in persons reports, which conditions how it ranks different nations, and that conditions things like foreign aid. And also, you know, the United States are one of our major exports are cultural products, including movies and music, and with that comes celebrity.
So that's a really great outline of the data that you generated and how you went about organizing it and whether it looked like a mess at some point in the research process.
All the time.
Well, congratulations then on producing a book which is in no respect messy. It's tremendously well organized. It was a joy, a pleasure to read. In that respect, there was no point in the book at which I felt lost or was struggling to work out what you were doing or why. So it's an exemplary model of interpretive political science. So you use both interpretive methods and feminist methods throughout the book. And before we take a short break and then talk about some of the specific results and some of your protagonists in more detail, I want to ask you about the relationship between these two sets of methods. I think listeners by now can intuit, you know, why these are methods that you've brought into conversation with one another in the book. But could you just spell out specifically how you thought about the relationship between them in designing and conducting the research and what we get from the combination of the two?
I will say, I think, and I feel like this has been a discussion in the interpretive methods community in political science, and I'm often one of the first to say, I didn't realize I was doing interpretive methods until quite later in the game. And so, you know, as you know very well, interpretive methods are concerned with questions of meaning. How do people make sense of the world? What can we read from, whether it's documents or individual activities or whatever the focus of study may be, about how people understand and interpret the world? And I wanted to understand, you know, how do these celebrities make sense of trafficking, and how might they speak about it in certain ways? And then from that, what could we read about bigger issues like feminist politics and political representation? I think that feminist and interpretive methods go hand in hand quite well. Feminist scholars, and particularly Black feminist scholars, have been some of the first to really critique positivism in the social sciences and the biases of Western rationality. And so there's always been this, I think, this very interpretive bent to a lot of feminist scholarship, just given its criticism of Western empiricism. And so there's, I think, that natural fit. But then I think what it brings to interpretive politics specifically is this attention to gender inequality and gender dynamics, but also as they intersect with things like race and class. And so I think it calls our attention to not only what might something mean, but how is it possibly reinforcing inequalities, and what can we learn from that about how to challenge those?
Yes, I think that all sounds right. And yet, correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense is that there's relatively little written in the manner in which you have written of the relationship between these two bodies of literature. And you've explicitly brought them into conversation in the Theory of Methods chapter of the book. And of course, throughout the other chapters of the book, when you present the data and your interpretations. And so that was one of the things I really admired about the work. But it also made me reflect on how in the classes that I teach, for instance, in interpretive methods, we're using feminist texts and discussing feminist theory. And yet we're not doing that work of thinking about what is gained by bringing them systematically into conversation with one another.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you can see this contribution. I think it's important to bring things into conversation, because I feel like in any discipline or any topic of study, we get caught up in our way of seeing the world. And as I always remind my graduate students, really, in the end, none of us are doing anything new. Much of what we're doing is building on other work that has come before us and improving it, expanding it. And so hopefully, you know, by bringing together feminist and interpretive scholarship more explicitly, that's just part of that ongoing project.
I agree. Sam, we need to take a short break here for a sponsor's message, and we'll come right back from that to pick up where we left off with narratives, ideology, and Ricky Martin, not necessarily in that order. A reminder that this is New Books in Interpretive Political and Social Science on the New Books Network, where Samantha Magic is talking about Lights, Camera, Feminism. Sam, let's turn now to the dominant narrative. You alluded to it already. If you could give a little bit more detail of what that dominant narrative consists of, perhaps from among the protagonists whom you've identified for the listeners already, which one of them echoes or speaks most explicitly to the dominant narrative?
The dominant narrative of human trafficking focuses almost exclusively on sex trafficking. I blame or credit, depending on your perspective, people like Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times for this narrative. It's a very racialized and gender narrative. So we see often a young, usually white girl, although, you know, increasingly the girls can be victims from the global south, or a woman, but it's more often a young girl who is trapped and coerced into the sex industry by usually a non-white or foreign man and criminal gang. We see this in movies like Taken, for example. So this criminal gang or these men who are often foreign or non-white capture the girls or women. They force them into sexual slavery. And then in this narrative, usually the women and girls are rescued by some combination of law enforcement and religious NGOs, possibly. They're saved from the sex industry, and the men are prosecuted and put in prison to the fullest degree. And so this is a very common narrative, and it's been internationalized. You know, sometimes we see older women, sometimes the men are not only men of color, but the general story remains the same. There's been a lot of critique in feminist and critical trafficking scholarship of this narrative. And it reinforces, as I say in the book, what I'd call a carceral feminist ideology. So this idea that we can kind of arrest our way out of social problems. If we just rely on law enforcement and the criminal justice system, we can solve gender inequality. And so I think most of the celebrities, with a couple of exceptions I focus on in the book, have dabbled in this narrative at some point, which is understandable. One, it's a made-for-TV narrative, and two, it's dominant. It's hard to disagree with that, right? And there's a lot of critique of celebrities in politics for taking on dominant narratives of almost any issue because it's palatable to a wide range of their fans. I see it in particular in my book with someone like Ashley Judd, for example, who is a celebrity. She's mostly known for her work in movies and on Broadway, and she has traveled and worked as an ambassador for an international NGO called Population Services International. And through them, she started to see what she perceived as sex trafficking when she visited in the Global South. And so, you know, she writes in her memoir about how these women were forced into prostitution, and she has called for a lot of carceral feminist solutions, like, for example, focusing on arresting men and to quote unquote end demand for prostitution, which would then in turn end demand for sex trafficking. That's not her only position on it. She has talked about how other factors like poverty and gender inequality and things like that, and even American imperialism, have created conditions that make people and women in particular vulnerable to forced labor. But she's one example of that narrative.
Okay. And so now what about the counter or competing narratives? What's the alternative being offered, and who is presenting that alternative?
There's been a lot of scholarly and critique, especially from sex worker rights activists, for many, many years. And these critics have said, one, this is an incredibly patronizing and racist narrative, for one. And two, it creates this idea that all women are victims and particularly men of color are universally predators. And it over-prioritizes and overvalues the criminal justice system's capacity to solve problems, while ignoring the fact that our investment in criminal justice solutions to human trafficking has done very, very little to help victims of trafficking and forced labor in places like the garment industry or in agriculture or in domestic labor. And it's also ignored that men and trans persons and other gender nonconforming people also might be victims, of course, of labor. And so they kind of point out these are all the different holes in it. I mean, I think one celebrity who really takes on what I call this more structurally oriented or structurally intersectional approach to trafficking is Julia Ormond. And so, you know, she came to human trafficking activism essentially through the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime. And one of the first places she visited was Lake Volta in Ghana, which has this very longstanding reputation for trafficking, particularly in the fishing industry. And so, you know, she did witness what looked to her like potentially child labor or trafficking in fishing. But then she soon realized that this is not unique to Ghana, and it's not unique to the Global South. And so she created an organization called ASSET to bring a broader perspective to how we think about trafficking. But also, she's done some pretty important legislative work on the ground. So her focus has really been on supply chains. As I'm sure everyone knows, this is how materials go from raw materials to finished goods. And there's a lot of discussion about what happens in that process in between and what are the labor practices. And so she was behind a bill that passed in California in 2012 called the California Trafficking and Supply Chains Act. And in its final form, the bill was quite watered down. It basically asks companies of a certain size to report what they're doing to make sure that their supply chains are free of coercive labor. This bill has been heavily criticized, and she even criticizes it herself for not being strong, not having a lot of teeth. But I think it does show where celebrities can kind of take this more complicated look at the issue of human trafficking and try to point out the structures that are facilitating this as opposed to just bad individuals.
Yes, that's really interesting because on the one hand, you're suggesting that that is a counter narrative to the conventional one, which you set out really clearly for us already. And yet it seems that we end up still with the carceral feminist solution to the problem. And UNODC, after all, is an exemplary carceral institution, right? What does it do other than combat what it identifies as criminality? So if we have what we might agree is a competing narrative, does it nevertheless lead to the same sets of solutions? Are there instances of celebrities that not only have tried to think through a competing or alternative narrative, but then also solutions that might be of ideologically other? And so here, of course, you identify three categories of feminist ideology. One you've been concentrating on thus far is the carceral. Another is the liberal, though sometimes it appears to be a neoliberal. And the third, which you mentioned a moment ago, also is structurally intersectional. So Are there instances of celebrities that engage in what at some point becomes clearly structural, intersectional, perhaps emancipatory in its character, or that it has an emancipatory potential and it's pushing against the dominant narrative? Or would that all be too many steps too far for people who, after all, at the end of the day, have to make movies and and sing songs and do things that will attract audiences?
I think it's a lot to ask of anyone in this issue space to advance the more complicated narrative, especially in a media scape that is increasingly click-driven. There isn't a lot of attention to kind of long, detailed, complex stories. And the point of a celebrity on an issue is to bring a lot of eyes to it, but also very much aware that these eyes aren't going to look at it for very long. You know, I think this is why a lot of celebrities, and I think this is actually not unique to celebrity activists, but they have an angle that they will take on this issue. And so another case I look at in the book is Ashton Kutcher, who takes a technology angle. And so he very much focuses on the internet and how web-based technologies can lead to sexual exploitation. And he has gone on to develop and promote this technology that, you know, ultimately comes back to a carceral solution, right? It's a technology that helps law enforcement scrape the web, usually for escort ads. How it works, I don't know. I tried to sign up for a training, but it was only open to law enforcement, so I could never figure that out. But it effectively, you know, from what I managed to read about it, it scrapes the web. And then from that, law enforcement can find ads that might be exploitative and then investigate those cases. Of course, what we're doing is we're coming back to using the police as the solution to this problem, which is really an economic problem. And what's happened in that case is this technology has actually meant a lot of consensual adult sex workers have been caught up in more police raids because this technology, like many technologies, is not accurate. We also have other solutions that can be wide-reaching. I talk about another one in the book that many celebrities, not necessarily in my case studies, were involved with, and it's called Shoe Revolt. This woman created a nonprofit. Well, it's unclear if it was a nonprofit, but celebrities would donate their shoes and then they sell the shoes online. Kristen Stewart's Keds went for $1,500. And then the proceeds of these sales would go to help fund victims of trafficking, whether it's through, you know, donations to NGOs or whatever the case might be. This is well-intentioned, don't get me wrong, but also we can't buy our way out of trafficking, right? Again, trafficking and coercive labor is a function of deeper structural problems of poverty, immigration, racism, all kinds of things, capitalism. You know, to think that we're going to buy shoes and solve trafficking is a little bit ambitious, let's put it that way.
Indeed. And one of the things that you discuss is how there is a tendency in much of this work to want to redeem the capitalist political economic order, that at the end of the day, the solution to the problem is more of the same, but done better.
Yes. And celebrities aren't alone in that. You know, there are many NGOs that promote very similar things. And we see this in a lot of spheres of activism, especially around environmental activism, actually, where, you know, we can buy products to stop climate change. I mean, the irony of that is rich.
That said, though, one of the things I think listeners will be grasping is that you really have done an excellent job as an interpretivist and a feminist scholar of thinking through the nuances of the different positions that your protagonists have. None of these are cardboard cutout characters on a stage. They're all grappling with their own positions. They're doing things like, you know, setting up organizations that you've mentioned and really committing themselves to projects. Some also go on quite steep learning curves. And it seems like Mia Sorvino is an example of someone who has changed her position quite dramatically over
Yes.
time. So tell us a bit about her, and how is it that some celebrities acknowledge that the positions they've taken early on may be wrongheaded, and that as they've gone on campaigning, they've learned things that have forced them to reconsider?
This is a great question, because human trafficking seems like an easy issue, right? Like, who is going to say, I support human trafficking? Nobody. But I think when anyone, celebrities or otherwise, starts to look into this issue, they see how complicated it is. There's barely any agreement on a definition of trafficking, and the numbers of victims are so hard to tell. And so I think anybody who's relatively smart might come into this issue thinking, wow, okay, this is an easy issue. I can use my brand or my celebrity to promote this, and then quickly realize what a minefield they've waded into. And I think this is what happened with Mira Sorvino. So she came to the issue through her work with Violence Against Women and Amnesty International. And then she became, like Julia Ormond, a UN ODC ambassador as well. And she, in a lot of her work, has promoted the dominant narrative. So she has this documentary called Every Day in Cambodia, where she goes and, you know, is exposing what she perceives as the horrors of trafficking in Cambodia, all the while presenting the Cambodian people as very stupid, for lack of a better phrase. She at one point yells at a Cambodian political leader for not doing enough about this issue. It's good for TV, but it's not showing a sophisticated understanding of the geopolitics of the region. She also has done activism in the U.S. context, where she has promoted carceral feminist solutions, like, for example, end demand. So arresting buyers of sexual services as a way to end demand for prostitution and, by extension, sex trafficking. And she also has promoted something called safe harbor laws. A problem with trafficking law enforcement is a lot of time young people are arrested, even though they're technically victims of trafficking. And so safe harbor laws would, in theory, help to stop arrests of these young people. Again, it's not a bad thing, but in practice, it often doesn't work. And so she promoted these different things at the National Council of State Legislatures. And then she learned over time that actually these different laws that she had been promoting weren't working as planned, and that many times people who should be considered victims were still being arrested, for example, and that children weren't being adequately protected because the resources aren't adequate. And to her credit, you know, she said, I have changed my position. I've learned a lot, and we can do better on these issues. And I don't want to tell sex workers, for example, what to do with their lives. So I think, and as I write about in this book, it's this interesting example of celebrity accountability, which is quite rare. You know, she takes accountability for the fact that she may have promoted a solution, but that was harmful, and she has owned up to it and learned. And, you know, this is wonderful that she's being so accountable. But I think the major problem here is that we have to rely on the individual celebrity to hold themselves accountable. Many of the other celebrities, for example, Ashton Kutcher has been called out many times for doing extremely problematic things in the trafficking space, and he only has gone on the defensive. This fact that we have to rely on these unelected representatives to hold themselves accountable is, I think, the bigger issue in all of this.
That, if I understand correctly, is one of the reasons that you describe these celebrities as being peculiarly distant when compared to, say, elected representatives. Your point then is that it's primarily because there's no effective way to hold them accountable. Is there something more to their relationship with their various audiences that gives them a distance which is unlike elected representatives?
It's not only the fact that they aren't directly elected by the communities for whom they claim to speak, but also at times their life experience is incredibly distant from the issues that they're talking about. Now, this doesn't mean that the only people who should speak about an issue are ones who have direct experience. You know, there's a long history of allyship and advocacy on issues with communities and people who are not directly impacted by an issue. But I think in the case of trafficking, the distance between the celebrities' experiences and the trafficking victims is often so extreme. Most victims of trafficking are in these situations because they're poor. And these celebrities, for the most part, are not poor. They also don't really have to respond to anybody if there is a problem. There just are not the accountability mechanisms in place. Now, arguably, people could say, well, people might stop watching their movies or they might lose advertiser sponsorship. But I think we've seen a lot more celebrities come back from those penalties than we've seen them permanently penalized. And I'm thinking of, you know, many of the different actors, especially with Me Too, male actors who disappeared for a little while and, you know, they're back on stage or on the screen or whatever the case might be.
In the conclusion of the book, you have a really interesting juxtaposition, I think, of the campaign around sexual violence in the film and entertainment industries and the Me Too movement. And really what it delivers for the reader is a very clear point about the difference between the manner in which these celebrity feminists engage with a campaign in which they are self-interested, in which they have direct experience in many cases, as against a campaign in which they are self-appointed representatives speaking and acting on behalf of others.
Yeah, this is a really interesting case because in the case of Me Too, there was this element of self-interest and experience. But what I think the celebrities did that was really interesting in this case is they told their own stories, but they used their fame to highlight work of women who have been doing anti-sexual violence work and work against sexual harassment on the ground for decades. And so I think I use in the book the example of the Golden Globes, where they bring women like Tarana Burke, for example, who coined the phrase Me Too long before Alyssa Milano said it, and A. Jen Poo, for example, who has long worked with domestic workers in New York City. They brought those women and they highlighted and used their celebrity to amplify the voices of people on the ground. And I think that can be a much more productive use of that fame capital, them claiming to speak for a population or a community.
On the point about accountability, just to tack back to it for a moment, you yourself had this experience of the celebrities you were researching being unaccountable. You approached them or tried to approach them to do interviews and you were unsuccessful. Why do you think that is, if some of them, if not all of them, do appear to be genuinely concerned about the anti-trafficking projects that they're engaged in, why would they refuse to speak to somebody like yourself for a project of the sort that you're conducting?
Now that the book is out, I'm not going to lie, I still think a celebrity is maybe going to sue me. There's this like, oh no, did I cite something wrong and a celebrity's going to sue me for libel and slander? I don't know. At the same time, none of them would speak with me. And I especially tried to interview the ones in my six case study celebrities, and I had no luck. So exactly as you say, you know, for a year when I was in Los Angeles on my sabbatical doing this research, I called their publicists, I called their managers, I sent emails. And if I wasn't flat out ignored, there were some polite back and forths, but generally the answer was no. And this was really interesting for me as a researcher who has done predominantly interview-based research over the years and other projects and generally never had a problem getting people to speak with me. And so, you know, in earlier drafts of the book, I harped on this point more, that these people wouldn't speak to me. How dare they? One of the reviewers said, I think you can dial it down on that because really, what are you going to get from talking to them other than maybe the public relations spin? You know, are you maybe going to be in the room with them and their manager and a lawyer and someone else and you know, you're not going to get that information. I am not convinced that it would have been totally futile. I think I could have gotten interesting details, like what were you thinking when you did this, or what did this mean to you? I think it might have been actually fascinating, but nobody would speak to me. And I think one, I mean, I'm not a high profile journalist in a major venue. I'm a professor at a small college in New York City. I mean, who do I think I am that they'd want to speak to me? Maybe that's the issue. But I was really surprised at the extent to which, like, in many cases, it was like I didn't exist.
Yeah, I think that a reviewer may not have read Leanne Fuji if they had, they would rate you. Like, there's always data to be generated in an interview context. But look, very briefly, because we are running short of time, I think that this begs a follow-up question, especially for research students and newly emerging researchers who might be in a similar situation. They haven't been able to get access. They haven't generated data that they thought they might. So, did you come up with some specific alternative to enable you to do work, generating other types of data and sort of therefore get to where you needed to be? What advice do you have, especially for research students and new researchers in a similar situation?
Well, I think, you know, it's the importance of pivoting, I guess, right? Because everybody generally in any research project, you're going to crash and burn at some point and things are not going to go as planned. And that's not unique to this project for me. With that being said, you know, in this case, I'm studying very public figures. These are people who've been in the public eye now for decades, and they've been very visible and very vocal on this particular issue. And so there are a lot of other materials that capture them in their positions. I found texts of UN speeches, there are press releases, there are interviews, there are the documentaries they appeared in. These are their products and their representations of themselves and their work. And so in the absence of anybody to speak with, this is where I went. And so my reply to, let's say, a celebrity who might want to sue me is that, well, you didn't speak to me and I would have loved to clarify these things with you. Yeah. And so I think to students or to people starting out, there are many ways to hear people speak and to take meaning from things. And I think in the case of very public figures, we have, especially in this day and age with so much material online, we have a lot of other sources where we can hear, in some cases, almost directly, even if it's edited or filtered through an organization or a documentary.
Sam, there are many other things I'd like to talk to you about, but in bringing the discussion to a close, you, in closing the book, write about future potential research projects, areas that the book didn't yet cover or covered to a limited extent that you think more work needs to be done on. Perhaps you can draw the listeners' attention to those and then have some of those become part of an ongoing research project for you. Where have you gone since the book was published or since you completed doing the work for it, in any case, from 2016 onwards?
Well, you know, Nick, writing a book, you finish it and it's the last thing you want to touch. Going back to Marx, where we started, I'm very alienated from my labor. So with this project, there are three different, I think at least three different areas I propose at the end. One is we definitely need a lot more study of celebrity in the global South. A lot of celebrity studies is very much based in the US and the UK. And I think expanding to the global South is important. Another area is with audience responses. And I'm speaking on an interpretive podcast and now maybe putting a plug in for experimental research, but there isn't a lot of comprehensive data about how audiences are actually responding to celebrities. And I do cite and refer in the book to some studies, like how did soccer fans respond to this tweet kind of studies. But I think talking to fans, and there is a whole genre of fan studies, but I think expanding audience responses, I think, is important. And then finally, one area that I may go into in a future project is around what we call, what some scholars have called micro celebrities or celebrity influencers. And so for people of a certain age, like myself, we still think of celebrities like the big name celebrities, the Angelina Jolies, Denzel Washington, Brad Pitt, what have you. Whereas a lot of younger people now who are increasingly online and in these more kind of siloed spaces, their celebrities are people like video game players on the Twitch platform or makeup influencers on Instagram. In terms of my own research, I am very excited to start a new project, totally different direction, on the politics of fat and fitness. And one of the things I want to look at are Instagram influencers and their politics and how they're promoting different ideas about fat and fitness to their very large fan bases.
Does that lead you into some of the work on the quantified self and the attention to sort of how quantification is an important
yes.
part of identifying and classing
quantifying
fat
and
fit people?
Commodifying the self. Yes, absolutely.
Well, I can't wait for your interpretivist breakdown and feminist breakdown. Again, another opportunity to bring those two literatures into conversation with one another. That's tremendous. Sam, to close the interview, we're going to experiment here because I heard on another channel of the New Books Network, and I'm embarrassed to say I can't plug it because I don't recall right now which one it was. The interviewer closed by asking the guest to name one or two books that they're currently reading that they would like to recommend to listeners. So I
Sure.
asked you by email if you'd do that, and you agreed to. So over to you. What have you been reading that you'd like to point the listeners' attention towards?
I've actually been trying to read more fiction. In the more scholarly space, I've actually been on a project the last just over a year and a half that looks at sex workers' engagement with online platforms. And one of the most brilliant books is On Camming by Angela Jones. Related to this book, I would highly recommend Nicole Alexander Floyd's book, Reimagining Black Women. And it's the subtitle is A Critique of Post-Feminist and Post-Racial Melodrama in Culture and Politics. And then also two books that I am very excited to read but have not yet read for my next project are Natalia Petrozella's Fit Nation. And the subtitle is The Gains and Pains of America's Exercise Obsession. And then the very recent hot off the press book by Kate Mann called Unshrinking, which is about diet culture. So I'm very excited to read those two.
I really admire Kate Mann's work. So thank you very much for letting me know that she's got a new piece of work out. I'll certainly look that up and we'll get all of the links to those
Absolutely.
onto
I'll
the
send those to you.
webpage. Samantha Magic, thank you so much for talking to me about Lights, Camera, Feminism, Celebrities, and Anti-Trafficking Politics.
Thank you, Nick, for taking the time. This was really fun. Thank you.
I enjoyed it greatly. And listeners, thanks for sticking with us for this, the 18th episode in this series, New Books in Interpretive Political and Social Science. You can find all of the other episodes on the series webpage. And in doing that, you'll see that there are all kinds of other series and channels on the network, and you can also do keyword searches. And among the thousands of other episodes on the site, one that might also be of interest to you that you can find is an interview I did years ago with Sever Molland on his book on anti-trafficking and sex trading along the Mekong called The Perfect Business. Whether it's that title or some other, including possibly interviews with the authors of those new works that Sam already mentioned, there's sure to be another interview of interest to you. So check out the website and subscribe.